traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Gabriel Grego, Quintessential Capital Management, thank you so much for joining this podcast. You are a short activist investor. There are probably few things more contrarian than being a short, especially nowadays when markets are rallying like crazy. You have a very specific process, and you only do a couple of trades a year. I think about 3 or 4 of these very high conviction trades, and you find these companies to short, and a lot of these turn out to be outright frauds. And obviously this approach has worked very well for you, as these stocks have traded down and in many cases to zero. So for you and your investors, obviously this has worked out, and so very grateful that you have taken the time to come on this podcast.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So maybe start from the beginning. How does this start? Like, how do you go about with locating these ideas?
Well, I think the locating is one of the most important part. And I think one of the reasons why I believe I have a high percentage of success as defined in terms of shorting companies that then end up going to zero within days or weeks is as much a matter of selecting the right target as of doing the right type of research on the company. So it's very important to find the right target, which inevitably entails rejecting a lot of good ideas, which for some reason or another are not good enough. So what I chose to do at the beginning of this activity was basically to focus myself on what I called extreme corporate catastrophic situations, which typically means only looking at companies where there is total or almost total accounting fraud, and or where management is committing some kind of serious crime. And of course, this situation must be somehow hidden to the public and to the market. Otherwise, there is nothing to bet on. So the important thing is looking for this situation, which are not, by definition, they're not easy to find, obviously, because management wants to keep the situation hidden. And the key word here is flexibility and open-mindedness. So you cannot stick to only one strategy or procedure to look for this kind of ideas, because they're very rare. And unless you have an open mind, you're going to have a very hard time finding them. So you need to use a combination of approaches. The most obvious approach is to come up with some kind of a screening mechanism, like an automatic software, say, that looks for companies which have certain red flags that in my experience and in other investors' experience have turned out more likely to have a risk of fraud. I'll tell you a few of the obvious determinants. For example, you want to look for companies that are not using a Big Four auditor, or which are using a Big Four auditor which lately has been involved in a lot of fraud. And I won't say any names here, but people who follow my activities will know what I'm talking about. You want to look for companies where they have a large unexplained discrepancy between cash flows and earnings in industries where you wouldn't expect it. Perhaps you want to look for a situation where receivables and inventory are abnormally high for a very long time, or maybe for companies which are too acquisitive. And finally, you might want to look for people that keep committing fraud, because it tends to be a lifelong bad habit. So very often, in order to commit a sophisticated accounting fraud in a public company, it's not enough to have a manager which is determined to do fraud. You need a whole bunch of accomplices or stakeholders which give you a hand. For example, the investment banks that takes you public. For example, the auditor. For example, a law firm. For example, all sort of service providers. So you will see that very often there is a, what I call the fraud ring. So not only the company is involved in fraud, but it's enabled to do this fraud by a bunch of service providers, such as the ones that I just mentioned, which tend to be known probably in the industry or not minding being associated to this kind of situation. So the advantage here is if you identify who those parties are, then you can keep looking at what it is that they're doing, and you will see that you will find a very high likelihood of finding something interesting within the companies that this gentleman or these entities are involved with.
That's
and then
really
finally, again, yeah. you gotta keep an open mind and, you know, reading newspapers and, you know, keeping track of whatever industry is very trendy at the moment, very sexy, because that's where a lot of fraud, fraudulent behavior is going to be clustered. So until recently was the cannabis industry, as you know, because it followed our free of play. Yeah. Before that, it was all the cryptocurrency blockchain craze. So every time you have, and now arguably is the COVID craze. A lot of companies are exploiting people's fear and greed about COVID and its cure, that a lot of companies are trying to pump their stock price just by claiming that they're doing something COVID related.
Wow.
So you want to keep track of these trends and identify them and be aware that that's where you want to go fishing, because that's where you're likely finding something interesting.
Wow, that's all fascinating. And the COVID angle is admittedly not one I would have even thought of. What type of stuff there is, do you think might be going on?
Well, a lot. The most obvious recent, but then now is already out in the open issue, was that there were a lot of companies essentially selling malfunctioning or non-functioning COVID diagnosis tests or antibodies tests, typically purchased in China and then sold in the United States, taking advantage of the kind of moratorium that the FDA temporarily put on COVID testing because of the urgency of the issue. In other words, it would be all of a sudden legal to sell and administer this Chinese COVID test, even without FDA approval. Now, it turned out that a lot of companies, some of them were moribund, they started selling this test, and this test had no reliability whatsoever, and some of them were even banned in China itself. So they get sold here in the West, but not in China because they don't work. So a lot of these companies were engaged in this deplorable behavior. Actually, my friend Nate Anderson from Hindenburg Research, I believe, exposed a couple of these. But then, even more than that, I'm sure there is a lot of companies which are claiming to have an effective vaccine or an effective cure or to work toward an effective cure. You should be very skeptical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you are on the long side of one of those companies, you got to watch out, because, if I were a fraudster today, that's where I would operate in the COVID space.
Very interesting. So it does sound like a lot of it is all done by almost a cartel of the same individuals, like you say, or people attached to them.
Not always. This tends to happen. We've seen this happening historically a lot. There were clusters of fraud. I mean, to just give you one example, there is this guy in Florida, Barry Honig, that was charged by the SEC for manipulating and pump and dumping and all that. I haven't kept track of this, so I don't know whether the procedures are still ongoing. I think maybe he settled. But in any case, you will see that these individuals and the entities around it have been involved in more than one situation that has been defined by some people as pump and dump schemes. Yeah. Riot Blockchain, to give an idea, but there were many others too. Yeah. So it could have been a successful strategy for a short seller to keep track of what this guy was up to and call him on his pump and dumps. Hmm. That's one idea, but there are other frauds which are not part of clusters. You know, they just arise out of the blue, and obviously those you need different strategies to find them.
Okay, so you have a screen here that you mentioned, and you look for these certain things. What is that? Still, is a pretty wide swath of companies. I think that would fall into these categories. Probably most, if not almost all of which are perfectly legitimate. But then what then is the next step in narrowing down your search?
Well, you know, there are certain, for example, you want to be skeptical of companies which are trading in a country, but they're domiciled in another country. Mm-hmm. I would say that a lot of the frauds that we exposed had this kind of characteristic. And the reason why is, because you make more money raising money, say, in the US or in the UK. And B, because if you're not domiciled, say, in the US, and you get caught as a fraudster, then it's harder for you to get prosecuted. You know, there needs to be extradition and the investigation is tougher. So that's another red flag, say. But I would say that if you run, you'd be surprised. Not many companies come out with extreme discrepancies between, say, free cash flow and earnings and auditor changes and maybe this domiciliation anomaly that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. If you do the search intelligently enough, you'll end up with, maybe with a couple of dozen targets. Mm-hmm. And then the next phase is to dig deeper and see if you find other things which are suspicious. Mm-hmm. And there is no textbook here. So it's an art as much as a science. Mm-hmm. And you need to look at what's going on and look at a company, see if there have been, for example, complaints or rumors or lawsuits. And you will see that almost always in any fraud, say, I won't be the first person that raised and raised some doubts. If it's a fraud, some people will have raised doubts, probably less vocal than I would. But you will find complaints, you will find negative reviews, you will find critical newspaper articles, perhaps. So the next stage is, A, see if somebody else has had your same suspicion and see what they're saying, and coming up with a kind of thesis. So you need to have a thesis, a wild guess, or an educated guess of what you think is going on at that company. So, for example, we exposed with you last month, Akazu, and the idea is that a lot of people, all they knew was that there was a rumor that the company may have been a fraud. That's it. And then I realized that the parent of that company 5 years ago was exposed by a publication similar to yours in the UK called ShareProfits.com. Mm-hmm. And the owner of that publication, who was a friend of mine called Tom Winifred, had written a one-page, very critical report of the company, suspecting that the number of users and the revenue of the company may have been fictitious. Now, we didn't go very deep with that article, but I think it raised some very good points. So I use that as a starting point. I say, okay, this guy's claiming this. Let's see if it's true. Then you want to ask yourself, assuming that it's true, why? Again, this is called the scientific method. So you run a hypothesis and you say, if that hypothesis is true, what kind of things can I predict about this company? For example, if I claim that the number of users of this music streaming app, Akazu, is inflated, well, you can make a prediction that the number of reviews on, say, Google Play or the Apple Store will probably be smaller than you would expect. Okay? Or maybe you can predict that the number of downloads of the apps, if you can figure out a way to estimate them, will probably be lower. or maybe you might guess that the number of employees would be lower than expected. And all of this in a proportional, on a proportional basis. And so what you do is you go check these objective signs or markers, and you see whether more or less they confirm your prediction. And if the prediction is not confirmed, then you look for more prediction. If all of them are not confirmed, then you're probably on the wrong track. And you should either change the pieces or move to a different target, because maybe you were wrong. On the other hand, if the prediction is correct, and if multiple predictions from multiple unrelated directions are correct, then you're probably on the right track. And once you convince yourself that the thesis is correct, at some point, your interest should shift from trying to understand if the thesis is correct to proving that it's correct, and finally to find a way to convince everybody else that it's correct. And all of these three phases entail very different strategies and tactics. And that's why the process takes a long time.
Yeah, yeah. How often do you get kind of thrown off or turned down, or how often do you come across ideas that you have to abandon? Like, what, once you get
not
to that
very
phase?
Often. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get ideas all the time, like the people that very often, like someone would suggest that we look at a company for one reason or another, and almost always they are unsuitable, either because the thesis is wrong, or because it's very hard to prove, or sometimes because even though the thesis is correct and it's easy to prove, there is not enough borrow in the stock. Unfortunately, well, yeah. That's the reason why we dropped them, and it's very sad because I know that these companies are bad. I could tell you right now a couple of companies that I know are fraud, no doubt about it. But we're just not going to do anything because we couldn't find enough more.
Wow, another reason to trade on a thin exchange if you're a fraud, I guess, right? So, interesting. Wow. Okay. And then you go then a step further, and you also do boots on the ground research. And I say this just because I've watched your videos of you showing up at some of these company addresses and trying to find if anybody actually works there, which is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Right. So then at what point do you go do that?
Yeah, that's something that I leave for the very end, because it's very time consuming. It's very expensive to do it in the right way, in a professional way. And, it's potentially risky.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to do that sort of thing only at the very end when you think you already have a strong thesis. And I called it like the cherry on the cake. I don't think that part is fundamental, but, I like to have it nonetheless.
At what point, if any, do you engage the company? Do you start asking them questions or any of that stuff?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't like speaking to fraudsters, and I don't like speaking to criminals. I don't think they're worthy of my direct attention, and anything they'll say would just be a lie.
Yeah.
So we never approach them.
Okay. So then they won't know about you until you come out with your report.
That's correct. Okay. It would be the worst day of their lives.
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned the Akazu, just a shameless plug that you put this out there on our first ever virtual investing conference. And it was thanks to that, actually, that made it such a success. And people can go back and listen to that and actually watch it on the website, contrarianpod.com. But so much for that. But okay, so do they ever find out about you being onto them at all, or before the report comes out, or?
No, okay. They don't. I am extremely careful with the secrecy in my investigation, and there is strict compartmentation, and I don't do anything to give them even the slightest idea that anybody is sniffing around. So I'm very, very, very careful with it. I take it as a military operation.
Yeah. And you do this pretty much on your own. You don't have much of a team of analysts that do this, right?
No, I do have a team. I have five people, including me, that work on these kind of things. Each one has a very defined job. And then also very often I outsource or I hire external consultants on a as needed basis to help out. So I would say that maybe I'm the, no, for sure, I'm probably the one doing most of the work. And I'm also the orchestra director, but it's definitely not only me. And there is a lot of people, a lot of courageous people that help me out with this.
Yeah, yeah. And then you do partner also with other shorts, like you mentioned Nate Anderson of Hindenburg Research and others.
For sure. Well, very often I get leads from other shorts, for example, and there is a lot of funds which have great ideas, but they don't have the in-house investigation capabilities to turn those ideas into actionable activist shorts. And sometimes even if they do have those capabilities, there are many funds which are very reluctant to engage into a public activist short campaign because it's risky from a legal and from other, from a reputational perspective too. It's very intense. It's very stressful and it requires a different skill set that your average long short hedge fund would have. So for example, it requires some legal, expertise. It requires the ability to handle the media and to communicate in a certain way. Not necessarily a great investing hedge fund would be a great activist fund. It's very different.
Very cool. All right. Gabriel Grego, thank you so much for all that stuff. Fascinating conversation here. I want to come back and ask you a little bit more about you and how you came to acquire all these skills that are necessary for this type of work. But let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Okay, welcome back. We're back with Gabriel Grego, Quintessential Capital Management. Gabriel, this is the segment of the show where I ask the guest a little bit more about themselves and how they came to this type of investing and their career so far. And you mentioned a bunch of different disparate skills that are required to do this type of work. So I think it's in your case, it might be particularly interesting to talk a little bit about your background and where you came from and how you came about this type of investing.
Sure. I'm originally Italian. I lived in Italy until I was 19. I started college in the US. And then after college, I worked briefly for a hedge fund in London. And then I moved to Israel for the following 15 years or so. And at this time, you know, with some breaks and other work experience in various other countries in Europe. Career-wise, I graduated in economics. I've been taking also a lot of courses in psychology. I have an MBA. And I'm on my way to finish a degree in mathematics and physics at the Open University, UK. As far as the professional experience, I worked at Shell for a period, the oil company, and I was part of their internal consulting team, strategic consulting team. And I would say probably for this job, the most formative experience was working for an investment bank in Israel, where I was in charge of large-scale real estate transaction, project financing, and leverage buyouts. So that was like traditional bread and butter investment banking. And that probably gave me a lot of skills because the idea was to receive some kind of a project. It could be an asset to acquire, a real estate property or an infrastructure project, analyzing it in depth, especially from a financial and strategic perspective, coming up with a financial model, and then pitching it to usually to lenders, so to banks or sometimes to private equity funds for debt or equity. So that was a good training in understanding an asset and communicating a thesis effectively. I worked, as I mentioned, in London for a brief period for a hedge fund. it was a hedge fund that was not an activist fund or not a value fund, but it probably taught me a little bit how the capital markets work and what are the ABC of managing a hedge fund. And then, you know, I had other experiences in my life which were not related to work. For example, I served in the military for a period. I was in the paratroopers. And I think that probably taught me also a certain approach to how to receive, call it a mission, how to plan it in a certain way, and how to execute it, even if the mission is very daring and potentially dangerous, but execute it in a way that limits the risk to an acceptable level. And that taught me that there is always a way to limit the risk and to maybe execute an operation in a easier or smarter or more efficient way than it would be intuitively possible at the beginning. It just takes a little more thinking. And probably I would say to be a good activist, short especially, you need good resilience and you need to be able to deal with adversity and setbacks and frustration and fear and really control your emotion. The level of emotions that are present at the early stages of a successful activist campaign can be maybe almost unlike anything I've ever encountered in the past. It's scary stuff, and you're basically pissing off these huge corporate entities, which are fighting for their survival and whose management is fighting for their physical freedom. And they know that their freedom and their survival depend on trying to destroy me. and these guys have vastly more financial and other resources at their disposal that we do. Mm. Especially when I did this at the beginning, when we were a much smaller and less experienced fund that maybe we are now. Mm-hmm. So deal with that is really no joke. It takes a lot of thinking, a lot of strategic analysis, a lot of thinking out of the box. But most importantly, it takes a lot of mental fortitude, because again, the attacks that this company can mount on you after you mess around with them, it can be extremely, extremely difficult to withstand. Mm. And it's important that you keep the fight all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. There are many of my colleagues that have different strategies. You know, they hit the company at the beginning and then kind of walk away a day or so afterwards. And I'm not like that. I mean, mm-hmm. if I attack, it's to kill. Mm. And it doesn't matter if it takes me 1 week or 6 months, the company's got to go down. And of course, they're going to try and fight as much as they can to avoid the bitter end, and the fight is not going to be easy for me, mm-hmm. or for my team.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that does sound genuinely terrifying, but I would think that jumping out of an airplane, having people shoot at you as a paratrooper is a little bit more terrifying, no?
Well, it's terrifying in different ways. I would say that the military, and this is probably a cliche, but it's a different experience mostly than what most people expect when they say, look at the army life, the life of a combat soldier, say on television. Yeah. And a lot of that life can be boring, is routine manual work, very hard manual work, and you know, lots of physical fitness, lots of training. Yeah. And the parts where you really see strong action or danger, there are few and far in between. When they do occur, it is very scary. Yeah. Even training sometimes can be very scary and very dangerous. You know, you train all the time with live ammunition. Yeah. There are accidents happening all the time. So it is scary, but it's a different type of fear. It's a fear that is very short term. Mm. So that fear lasts only as long as the exercise lasts or the battle lasts, and which is usually from a few minutes to a few hours. And then you go to sleep very nicely at night, because you know that your long-term needs are taken care of by the army. Right. So you don't need to worry about anything except being alive and performing your job as well as you can. Mm-hmm. But when you go to sleep soundly. With activism, it's very different. With activism, until the battle is over, and sometimes the battle can take, in my case, can take months sometime, in case of my colleagues can take years. Yeah. You don't sleep well at night until the battle is over. because, you know, the justice system moves very slowly, and there are many more moving parts. So the battle, when you're attacking one of these companies on multiple fronts, it's on, of course, on the front of convincing the investors. It's on the front of convincing public opinion, so on the media front, which is your realm of expertise. It's on the legal front sometimes, if there are investigation or legal proceedings. On the financial front, if the company is trying to secure credit. So it's a multiple front battle, very complex, very complicated, that takes a long time. And stress that takes a long time is a different beast from, say, the extreme stress that you experience in the military if you're getting into a firefight. You see?
Yeah.
So it helps, but it's not a complete substitute.
Totally. Okay. So then, as far as your fund, it's been around now for a couple of years, right? And this is your first fund that you launched?
No.
Okay.
My fund, no. My fund has been around for 6-7 years now.
Okay.
We launched in 2013.
All right.
And before that, I was running managed accounts.
Okay.
The fund that opened 2 years ago, it's a short-only fund, which is basically it's a privilege that we offer to the investor in the long-short fund in case they want to get additional exposure only to the activist operation. So that fund is called Quintessential Pure Activist Fund.
Oh,
but the flagship fund, which is long and short, it's called Quintessential Capital Fund, that launched in 2013.
Oh, okay. So this is only like a best ideas type of thing. So you do actually invest on the long side as well.
Yes.
So what?
We do.
Okay. And so I guess that would be a good lead into the next question, which is your views of the markets. Where are you invest? What does your book look like these days as far as exposure? What is it typically the exposure of the long short book? Like, what does it vary?
Well, it's two slightly different questions, because I think these are not normal times that we're living. These are by all means extraordinary times. And I think the portfolio reflected this until recently. Like, recently I started to normalize things a bit. But say the idea behind the fund is that we only have a handful of these activist shorts operation per year, but you still need to have capital because you need collateral for selling short stocks. And the idea is, why would I leave all this collateral in cash when I can invest it in high quality, long-term compounding stocks, hopefully purchase at a discount in terms of fear and crisis. So my idea is, yes, we spend 70 or 80% of the time short selling, but we spend some time going long as well. And the idea is to look for one decision stocks. So again, very high quality stocks with competitive advantages, good management teams, and healthy industries. And the idea is we wait for extreme fear to buy those. And then once we buy them, we just usually keep them in the portfolio for years and never touch them again.
Okay.
Now, to give you an example, we did a lot of buying in mid-March when there was the peak of the fear for the epidemics. And we bought a lot in December 2018.
Yeah, I remember.
Was it December 2018? Yes.
Yeah,
during the Christmas, almost bear market. So that's the time that we do the buying. The rest of the time, we usually do nothing
on the
long side. We do some activist longs. So we are involved right now in one activist long operation in Japan. But most of the time, we focus on the short. So I think this is an advantage because I believe that alpha in the long side is very hard to find. So if you are an average fund that is, you feel this urge of acting all the time, and most of the time there is no alpha. So additional action doesn't bring any benefit. I think the few times where you do find alpha in the market is when there is panic. And that's when, that's where we do most of the long work. In terms of right now, we entered the 2020 year very well because we had a very good performance last year. I thought valuations were a little expensive in general. So what I did since the end of 2019, I started creating some liquidity, not really selling existing position, but not deploying new capital coming into the fund, and maybe shifting some of the investment to market neutral ones, like either activist operations, or we do a little bit of merger arbitrage as well, usually safe merger arb. So when the COVID crisis started approaching the horizon, I had a feeling that it was going to be really bad. I hashed the portfolio at the beginning of the market downturn, not at the very, not immediately, but very soon. And at the same time, I liquidated all the market neutral operations that we had and created some liquidity. And those obviously didn't move very much in the early stages of the coronavirus bear market, because again, they're market neutral. And then what happened is around mid-March, I felt that the downturn, at least in the short term, was overdone. I saw the Fed moving very aggressively. So I did what I normally never do, which is kind of time the market. And I said, okay, fine. I closed all the hedges and I took all the liquidity that was coming from the liquidated merger arbs and I put it into mostly new position and some old position that I thought had become too cheap. Mm-hmm. Now, the rationale was like this, because you had three choices if you wanted to buy in that period, right? The first choice was, hey, go deep value, so buy the stocks which have been killed the most. In that case, would have been go for the industries that were directly affected by coronavirus, for example, transport, energy, hospitality, airlines, that sort of thing. And I thought that was too risky, A, because it's too risky in general, and B, because I had a feeling that this was going to be a longer crisis than most people were expecting. Also because I'm from Milan. So all my friends are from Milan. I kept hearing all the time what was the situation there firsthand from my friend. The other option is the other way around completely, is you buy stocks which are not at all affected by the coronavirus crisis, which might even benefit. That would have been buying the Netflix and the Amazon, for example. Mm. And I didn't do that either because I figured those are the only stocks that probably didn't go down. Mm. And what I chose to do is a kind of a compromise. So buying companies which were not directly affected by the crisis, but which were likely affected to some extent indirectly in the short term. To give an example, and that's the two stocks that I bought, was Google and Facebook. I already had large position in them in the portfolio, and in the early stages of the downturn, those stocks went down severely as well. I think 40% each. And it makes sense they go down because obviously they make money out of advertisement. Advertisement is one of the first things that gets cut if there is a recession. Right. But I figured, hey, yes, advertisement gets cut, but they're probably going to capture whatever advertisement is left that's not going to get cut because all of a sudden people are spending more time online. They're spending more time on social media, so they capture a wider proportion of eyeball share, so to speak. B, these companies are very rich in cash and very cash generative. So there is no doubt that they will weather the storm. And finally, consumer behavior is likely to change because of this prolonged lockdown and this fear of the coronavirus. And once you start increasing the amount of time you spend on social media, even when the situation reverts back to normal, probably you develop some habits which will be sticky. For example, if you didn't use Facebook at all before the coronavirus, but then all of a sudden Facebook became your only venue for social interaction because the real life thing is not an option, then probably you're going to be a regular user of Facebook even when things go back to normal. Mm-hmm. So you will find these companies left with probably more market share, a wider pool of users, arguably more experience. And those companies went down severely, mm-hmm. not as much as airlines, but still very much. Mm-hmm. So I thought buying those made sense. And mm-hmm. We also bought some safer things, such as Visa, for example. We took a position. We enlarged our position in American Express. Again, the rationale is overall spending will go down because the consumer is spending less, but that's a short-term phenomenon. In the long term, you're going to have a lot of new people which are no longer going to touch cash and are going to stick to credit card even after the crisis is over, for example. So that was pretty much the rationale. We left a little bit, a few hedges in place. So we went up a lot during the rebound, but probably a little bit less in the market. But I still felt that I had the duty to protect my investors just in case this rebound in the market didn't happen. And the velocity and the violence of this rebound actually surprised us, I guess, together as everybody else.
Yeah, I was going to say, probably surprise just about everybody. And so right now, you see no reason to put these hedges back on and to protect the long positions at all?
Well, the hedges now are very expensive. So when I bought those, we hedged the portfolio with S&P puts.
Sure.
And the volatility at the beginning of the crisis was still not, and by the beginning, I mean the end of February or very beginning of March. There was a window of maybe 1 week where volatility was still not crazy, and you could still buy those puts at a reasonable price. Right now, puts on the S&P are very expensive, and so that's not an option. The other option is, you know, buying, you know, ETF. And having short position, single name short positions open. And we did a little bit of that. I normally don't do it. I don't short other people's activist campaigns. But, in this situation, I made kind of an exception thinking that, hey, I want to have a little bit of a hedge in the portfolio as well. And so we made a selection of all the activist campaigns launched by other funds, which I think made sense. And shorted some of those companies. So to that extent, we have a little bit of a hedge, but not much.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What might people be able to expect from your next short idea? Obviously, after everything we just talked about, it's keeping it secret is paramount. And you did mention some industries at the outset that you were looking at. But are there any other areas that you think might be good for looking for these activist shorts that you like?
No. Meaning, when I mentioned those areas, I was speaking only in general terms. In this case, we're actually looking bottom up, not top down. So I'm scanning some companies which are having signs of having something problematic, and not necessarily all of them are in any of the industries that I mentioned earlier. I would say that probably Chinese companies traded in the United States, some of them look very, very interesting. Many of them have surfaced recently, and they have been attacked by some of our colleagues. And I would say that Chinese frauds are a different beast. They behave in a different way for all sorts of reasons, so they must be tackled in a different way too. But that's definitely another direction that we're looking at. Because there is no shortage of fraudulent companies there.
But you haven't done any activist campaigns against Chinese companies yet, have you?
No, I don't think.
Yeah,
we haven't.
So that will be a first for you guys.
The reason why we haven't is that it's a place where you need very good local expertise.
Right.
So there are language barriers. There are, cultural barriers. And also, as I said, there are different issues that you don't have with other companies. For example, I'm convinced that there is a concerted effort, deliberate effort to manipulate the price of the stocks to limit the impact of activist attacks. And this is only for Chinese stocks. I don't know if you've been following what happened with GSX, for example.
No.
So GSX is a Chinese education company traded in the US, a large company, multi-billion dollar market cap. Was recently attacked by three funds. The Grizzly Bear, I think, was the first one. Then Andrew Left wrote something. And then finally, Muddy Waters. All of them launched an attack where they attacked the company from different angles, but they were all saying the same thing, that the company's a fraud. And I have very few reason to doubt that the thesis is correct. So the company reacted. The stock went down a little bit, like less than 10%. But then within the day, it rebounded all the way up pretty much, and then it keeps trading on a very narrow band. And there is no reason for the stock to react like that. I mean, the consensus among its investor base is that this is a fraud. You haven't even seen the other side of the thesis, except from what the company say, but the company always denies, right? And so there is a discrepancy between the way the stock is reacting and the way the consensus has formed. And I have no doubt that this is the management of the company, perhaps helped out by some of their buddies in China, buying strategically the stock to avoid the price from collapsing. Why am I so sure? Because I've seen it happening over and over in other Chinese fraud that were exposed. So that is something which is very unethical, illegal, by the way. This happened, and if you want to short the Chinese stock, it's something you have to take into account. Mm-hmm. And we're looking for ways to get around that. And I'm not going to disclose the secret sauce, but I have a few ideas how we can get around that problem if we ever want to attack a Chinese company.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I guess that's just it. I mean, maybe in closing, you just tell us where tell listeners where they can find you, and we put that on the in the show notes as well. You have a pretty active Twitter there, which is what, QCM Funds, I believe.
Yep, QCM Funds is our Twitter handle, and we also have a generic email that if any of your listeners have a smart short idea, to please reach out, and we'll find some way to collaborate. Our criteria are: we want at least $1 billion market cap. It must be either a total fraud or engaged in serious crime. And traded in a major stock exchange. So the email address is info@qcmfunds.com.
info@qcmfunds.com. I'll put that in the show notes as well. All right, Gabriel Grego, thank you again so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.